We are back. After Dark Patreon. Thank you for your support. It's been a great month for us on Patreon, Brad. There was a day here where it was just boom, boom, new patron, new patron. Feels good, man.
Yeah, it does. And if you are a new one or sticking around, remember, we're all reading, all of us Patreon folks, we're reading Ficciones, or Fiction in English, the great landmark short story collection by Jorge Luis Borges. We're reading that. We're talking about it in the Telegram, t.me/artofdarkpod. If you're a Patreon supporter, you probably already know that. April 16th, we're going to hang out, talk about it. It's going to be a blast.
Wunderbar.
Yeah.
Wunderbar. I see that Owen is connecting to audio still. Owen is okay. Here. We see you, Owen. We have to say, and if you want to opt out of the book club, you don't have to.
Oh, you don't have to do it. No,
it's optional. It's an additional perk if you're a patron. And we're prepping some very exciting stuff right now. I know you've got Borges coming up, Brad, and you're giving me that look, just that big-eyed look. So are you ready? You ready to rock?
Yeah. Well, I need this week, but it will be ready, and it's good, and it's interesting. And our friend Aldous Asterian is joining us for that as well. He's bringing the heat. I'm really looking forward to that one.
And I've got Marilyn in the queue. I am excited, although it's quite a story. It's quite a sad tale, especially knowing the way that it ends. But we will come to it. I think Owen is a few technical difficulties, but that's all right.
That's okay. Yep.
Yeah, we got some gremlins in the system. It was actually very funny because we had to do a few do-overs at the beginning to sort of get the intro right and get everything set up properly. Yep. And that made me think of a funny short story concept. If someone wants to take this and run with it, you just owe us 20 to 30% of the royalties to be determined in writing by the show's lawyer, Dan Baltic. In fact, if you steal the idea, Dan and his minions will come for you. I am kidding.
You don't want to cross the Nut Buddies.
But you know what? Listen, if it became a war between the Nut Buddies and our patrons, I'd side with our patrons for sure. Yeah. Naturally. So, but it would be very funny, right? Like a couple of doofy Midwestern podcasters.
I don't know any of those guys.
Start reading the natal chart after like a rediscovered birth certificate or something, or this theory that maybe something's been hidden of a figure like Walt Disney or maybe Ron Hubbard, possibly. And they read the natal chart, they do a podcast about it, and then the black van shows up. I like that idea for a screenplay or a movie that or a play or something. Could be very, very fun.
Yeah, no, I like it because you get the ESP, you get the paranoia, you get the sort of, you can make it a little noir-y, but it's also the occult. So to me, anytime you throw the occult, the esoteric into it, I'm immediately, my eyebrows go up. You know,
I'm going to write that idea down because I'm always looking for a new idea for a screenplay or something. It could be really funny. You know, you have a couple of podcast co-hosts. One of them is skeptical, doesn't believe in it.
Right. Of course, you got to have that guy. Right. Today on Twitter, Aldous Asterian and I, he said something about somewhere there must be the world's stupidest genius, right?
I saw this.
And it just made me think of that.
And the smartest dumb guy. Seen. Yeah, right. Terrible. Not a midwit, not a moron, not a genius, but on the cusp, cusper. Yeah. Right. I know Owen's trying to connect, but while he is, why don't I get into the first of the two topics that I said I was going to cover on the After Dark here. So they're talking about the 30s Mickey Mouse Club, the money. They're not quite there. Right. And then into this morass strode Herman Kamen, known to everyone. And Kamen did seem to know everyone as Kay. Kamen was, one acquaintance said, one of the homeliest men I had ever seen. He was a large, shapeless, here, I'm going to let him in.
Okay. I was just
ungainly man with a spatulate nose and thick pop bottle bottomed glasses, and he parted his black hair unfashionably down the middle of his scalp, only adding to the impression of his gaucheness. Don't worry, Owen, I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about Herman Cayman. What is his name?
Herman Cayman.
Cayman. Yeah. K. Cayman. But yeah. It goes on. Yet this look was partly by disguise. One associate said that Cayman was proud of his homeliness and used it to ingratiate himself with customers in his chosen profession, at which he was a master. Kay was born to sell. I'm going to go on.
Okay.
He'd come from a Jewish family in Baltimore, quit school to become a hat salesman, and after years on the road, where he became an expert pinochle player, joined an apartment store promotional firm in Kansas City. He and a colleague there, an advertising man named Streeter Blair, left to form their own company, Cayman Blair, also headquartered in Kansas City, which, like the one they had departed, specialized in creating displays and campaigns for department stores. One of those displays for a store in L.A. apparently caught Walt Disney's eye in 32 when he was burning over Borgfeldt's dereliction. This is another character. And he wired Cayman to gauge his interest in promoting Mickey Mouse. Cayman, then in New York on business, left for California that very day. It's like Mad Men. You get the call from someone like Disney or Hilton. You're like, yes, sir, I will be on a plane. Reading a little more. When he arrived at the studio, as Roy remembered it, Cayman walked into Roy's office and said, I don't know how much business you're doing, but I'll guarantee you that much business and give you 50% of everything I do over. It was a sign both of his salesmanship and of the rather offhanded way the company conducted business that they signed a contract with him that July, after their previous agreement expired. Under its terms, the studio was to receive 60% of the first 100,000 in royalties, with the 50-50 split thereafter, and Cayman was to foot all expenses, including his staff, the New York office, and a showroom and hotel suite in Chicago. Now, Cayman, that's a good deal. Mm-hmm. That's like the famous story about, what is her name? The actor who played Princess Leia in Carrie Fisher.
Yeah.
In Star Wars, her agent, I think, negotiated for points on merch.
Ooh.
Good job. A little more about this. I think this is fascinating. And Owen, good to have you here. I see you.
Yeah, back. I'm back. Yeah. Finally.
All right. Yep. Yeah.
Okay. You made it. Well, I just think this is so interesting. Now Cayman set out to do for Walt Disney Enterprises, the new merchandise arm of the studio, what Walt had been doing for Walt Disney Productions in filmmaking. He was going to reinvent it, transform it into a sleek, quality-controlled, revenue-producing operation that would in time have the added effect of making Mickey Mouse even more popular as a brand than he was as a movie star. Believing that Disney should be affiliated with only the finest manufacturers, Cayman quickly canceled contracts with less prestigious and aggressive companies and signed up with bigger and better ones. National Dairy Products, Ingersoll Watches, General Foods, which would shortly pay $1 million for the rights to put Mickey Mouse and his friends on Post-Toasties cereal boxes, and even Cartier Watches, which was soon marketing a diamond Mickey Mouse bracelet. However, his greatest achievement, Cayman said, was getting the Three Little Pigs up in lights in New York's strictly kosher ghetto and making them like it.
Interesting.
This could go on and on, but let me just read the punchline here. He was a whirlwind. Within a year, there were 40 licenses for Mickey Mouse products. A year after that, in 34, Cayman, with a staff numbering 15 in New York alone, had helped orchestrate $35 million. And I assume that's 1934.
Probably, yeah.
Millions in of sales in Disney merchandise in the U.S. and an equal amount overseas.
Yeah,
and
you get a 15 to 20x that, if I remember right, to get that modern
bonkers amount of money. Yeah, and he had opened branches across Europe and even in Australia. I mean, and it goes on. Shoppers, this is from the New York Times. Shoppers carry Mickey Mouse satchels and briefcases, bursting with Mickey Mouse soap, candy, playing cards, bridge favors, hairbrushes, chinaware, alarm clocks, and hot water bottles wrapped in Mickey Mouse paper tied with Mickey Mouse ribbons and paid for out of Mickey Mouse purses with savings hoarded in Mickey Mouse banks. Children, it continued, lived in a new Mickey Mouse world. They wear Mickey Mouse caps, waists, socks, shoes, slippers, garters, mittens, aprons, bibs and underthings, and beneath Mickey Mouse rain caps and umbrellas. They go to school where Mickey Mouse desk outfits turn lessons into pleasures. They play with Mickey Mouse velocipedes, footballs, baseballs, bounce balls, bats, catching gloves, boxing gloves, dollhouses, doll dishes, tops, blocks, drums, puzzles, games, paint sets, sewing sets, drawing sets, stamping sets, jack sets, bubble sets, pull toys, push toys, animated toys, tents, camp stools, sand pails, masks, blackboards, and balloons. And even that list did not begin to exhaust the number of Mickey Mouse products.
Wild. Wild.
Yeah.
Yeah, Disney's not doing all of this alone.
No, but there's still, getting back to Owen and his reading and everything, that's that Capricorn-ness applied to the artistic. Was it Virgo?
It's the Libra thing, because Libra is all about coming up with a relatable, comprehensible, beautiful image. Branding is really a Gemini thing, and it's fascinating because if you look at the generation Disney was from, everyone born within about 10 years on either end of 1900 had Pluto in Gemini. Wherever Pluto is in a generation, because Pluto moves very slowly, so for 20 years you've got Pluto in Gemini. Wherever Pluto is, that's what the fundamental drive within everyone of that generation is. And Gemini is the sign of branding. It is the sign of marketing. It is the sign of salesmanship more broadly, communicating, making things comprehensible. You take a look at Colonel Sanders, for instance. He had some very prominent Gemini. That's the thing. You've got like a template. You've got a franchise where you can just stamp the thing onto literally anything. You can reproduce it, copy it, Xerox it, 100% identical to how it is anywhere else on Earth, and you'll be getting the same product. So this obviously is lucrative. Gemini being a mercurial sign, Mercury sign, Mercury, mercantile, merchandising, that kind of thing. It's no coincidence that all of these words sound the same. That's what Gemini does, marketing.
Wow. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. And that
it didn't used to be this way either. This was a new phenomenon.
Yeah. Selling things
at
this way.
Scale. Yeah. And then also just like licensing deals. You can use Mickey to sell your candy cigarettes to kids or whatever. I'm sure they didn't allow that, a little off brand, but you get the idea.
There was new logistical innovations, manufacturing innovations, things where the world was getting smaller in some ways, right? Mm-hmm. So that allowed you to do this sort of thing that couldn't be done technologically, you know, say two generations before. Very interesting.
Well, I have the second part of the After Dark, and this is about their plans after Disneyland opened. Now, so I'll read a few paras here.
Yeah.
Almost as soon as Disneyland opened, Walt had been peppered with questions about whether he would build another theme park. In fact, though Walt always disavowed plans to erect a new park, claiming that Disneyland was unique and that he couldn't imagine having a park that wasn't close enough for him to supervise, in 1958, he and NBC, apparently realizing that it had missed out on Disneyland, jointly commissioned SRI to do a feasibility study for a park off the New Jersey Turnpike in the marshland near Secaucus. The report concluded that it would require 76,000 hours of ride capacity as compared to 46,000 at Disneyland at the time, that it could operate for only 120 days annually, given the weather, that it would cost $46.4 million, and that it would yield a low return on the investment that does not point to a profitable venture. Walt had his own doubts. He didn't feel that the New York area would support a theme park because, he told Harrison Price, that audience is not responsive.
Was he saying something anti-Semitic there?
No, nobody was saying that. What would make you think that? Of course, he did have a reputation for that, did he not?
Yeah.
That's all. Okay. All right. Walt had his own doubts. He didn't feel that the New York. Oh, I already read that. Hang on. Mm-hmm. Other offers came from the new Brazilian capital of Brasilia. Walt is interested and might come to Brazil personally if the whole thing looks promising, a Disney executive told officials. Niagara Falls, Monterey, California, and Kansas City. The most promising prospect was a plan for downtown St. Louis, which Walt apparently had encouraged when a commission planning the city's 200th anniversary asked if the studio might produce a film for the occasion, and Walt countered with the suggestion for a development. Officials pounced on the idea. we want the mouse to live here. I don't know. They don't talk like that in St. Louis.
They don't.
Yeah. Just channeling. It's like Project Paperclip all up and down the line, isn't it? A delegation from St. Louis, including the city's mayor, met with Walt at the studio in March of 63, after which Walt called in Harrison Price to conduct yet another feasibility study. 2 months later, Walt visited St. Louis himself with Lillian Sharon and Sharon's husband to assess the redevelopment area called the Riverfront Zone, and he made another visit in November, at which time he laid out his terms. The local Civic Center Redevelopment Corporation would provide a building to house the attractions, and Disney would provide the attractions themselves, when the Disney company, which the Disney company would own and control. By the end of the month, he was meeting with WED Imagineers. I love that, Imagineers, to discuss potential exhibits. A Circarama film on St. Louis, an audio animatronic exhibition, a New Orleans French district, a haunted house, an Audubon bird room, a Davy Crockett cave, and a pirate ship walkthrough.
Yeah.
That goes on. Walt continued to confer both with St. Louis officials and with his Imagineers through the spring. I really have a hard time reading Imagineers with a straight face. And it's just such an ugly portmanteau. And in July, the New York Times reported that Disney had finally committed to a second Disneyland, an indoor park to be installed in a five-story building in the downtown St. Louis area. But Walt hadn't committed to anything yet. And despite the news story, he wrote one correspondent that the St. Louis project is only in the talking stage. By the end of the year, he had lost interest. Some claimed falsely that August Busch Jr., the head of the Anheuser-Busch Brewery located in St. Louis, had scolded Walt and called him crazy for declaring that liquor would not be sold on the premises.
There's some things you got to know about the Midwest. I think Walt was on the West Coast for too long.
Yeah.
What year was this?
This was in the early 60s.
Okay, because 1963 is when they built the arch out there in St. Louis.
Oh, is that right?
Right around that time.
We'll just close this out with, but the real reason may have been that Walt by that time had found another better location. From the beginning, when he had first contemplated another theme park, one of the most logical sites was Florida, largely because of the weather. And as early as 1959, Walt candidly told a reporter for the Miami Herald that he had been driving around the state and had come to the conclusion that Florida would be better than California in many ways. This wasn't idle talk. At the time, Walt was already in discussions with RCA and with multimillionaire John D. MacArthur, head of Bankers Life Insurance, about developing a recreational enterprise called the City of Tomorrow on 5,000 to 6,000 acres north of Palm Beach that MacArthur owned. And of course, we know where this lands. This lands with Disney World, Epcot, and all of it. Yeah. Is there anything
just,
in
I was just looking up the Disney World October 7th. 1971. No, October 1st, 1971. Interesting.
That's a smart time to open that too, because it's right when things are starting to get cool up north. You tilt the camera, you pan the camera around, sunshine 365. Forget about the alligators. Forget about the Florida man. We got Disney World. Disney.
Yeah.
Is there anything from his chart that you looked at, Owen, that would indicate I guess it's kind of like almost like imperial ambition.
100%. Yeah. I mean, with Sagittarius, it's global. It's a global perspective. You know, that's why I was joining down to South America. That's why I was going to Argentina, drawing Mickey Mouse for the kids and stuff like that. It's big ideas and a big perspective. That's what Sagittarius is about. But you mentioned that the opening date of Disney World in Florida, I'll just put that into my calculator here.
Yeah.
And it's very funny because, you know, again, this concern with the future, Epcot. Well, this is what we were saying about Sagittarius. It's a visionary. It's always looking out to the next horizon, forward into the future, stuff like that. Very concerned with the future. And it's a funny thing. The Gemini element, the Pluto-Gemini element, is causing him to... Gemini is like the sign of the neighborhood. Gemini is the sign not only of the image, the brand, it's just everything that's local, it's everything that pops out, neon lights, bright advertising, that kind of thing. And so you take this cartoonish element, you take the caricaturesque element of Gemini, you put it together with the futurism of Sagittarius, and then you get something like a model city of the future. You know, if you go back to this era, people were always talking about the future. Uranus at the time, and I need to contextualize this a bit, Uranus was in Sagittarius around 1900. That basically is putting people's thoughts on the future. Next time Uranus was in Sagittarius was in late 80s, mid-80s. That was the, space, aliens, new age, all of that kind of stuff, the Sagittarius. But yeah, basically, the futurism, that Sagittarius, the kind of a model neighborhood, that's Gemini. If you put them together, Sagittarius is distinct worlds. Gemini is like a neighborhood, a small network, local network. And you put them together and you get like a hub made out of different zones. You have the Epcot future zone. You have the fantasy zone. You have the kind of, I don't know, what else is in Disneyland? You have the Star Wars one. You have just all of these little model communities where the reality has been constructed meticulously, perfectly. And again, if you take a look at the opening time for Disney World in Florida, you've got mirroring Walt's natal chart, as is often the case. You've got Jupiter in Sagittarius conjoined to Neptune. That's the ideal vision of the future. And that's opposing Saturn in Gemini. So that's a painstaking effort to construct a beautiful image and, more broadly, just a little self-contained neighborhood type thing. Not only that, they're both opposing one another. So as I said, they're fused into a third thing, combining elements of both.
Wow. Fascinating. Wow. I've got a little more from...
Yes. Holy smokes.
Very interesting. I've got a little more, and then maybe we can hear a bit about the chart around Walt Disney World as it relates to what I'm going to read now. This is from the Daily Beast about the title of this article. To give you an idea of what you're in for here is how the CIA helped Disney conquer Florida. Ah, let's go. Disney's key contact was the consummate cloak and dagger operator William Wild Bill Donovan. God bless America. Sometimes called the father of the CIA, he was also the founding partner of Donovan, Leisure, Newton, and Irvin. And Dewey, Cheatham & Howe, a New York law firm whose attorneys included future CIA director William Casey. Donovan's, I guarantee these guys are all members of Club 33. Donovan's attorneys provided fake identities for Disney agents. They also set up, and they're talking about buying land down in Florida. They also set up a secret communication center and orchestrated a disinformation campaign. In order to maintain control over the overall development, Disney and his advisors realized the company would have to find a way to limit the voting power of the private residents, though they acknowledged their efforts violated the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution.
Nothing gets in the way of Disney, though.
Here again, the CIA was there to help. Disney's principal legal strategist for Florida. These people are playing the level that I play at. I've got more. This is very interesting. The principal legal strategist for Florida was a senior clandestine operative named Paul Helliwell. Having helped launch the CIA secret war in Indochina, Helliwell relocated to Miami in 1960 in order to coordinate dirty tricks against Castro. At a secret seminar Disney convened in May of 1965, Helliwell came up with the approach that to this day allows the Disney organization to avoid taxation and environmental regulation, as well as maintain immunity from the U.S. Constitution. It was the same strategy the CIA pursued in the foreign countries. Set up a puppet government, then use that regime to do your bidding. Though no one lived there, Helliwell advised Disney to establish at least two phantom cities, then use these fake governments to control land use and make sure the public monies the theme park generated stayed in Disney's private hands. On paper, Disney World cities would be regular American hometowns, except their only official resident would be the handful of handpicked Disney loyalists who periodically elected the officials who, in turn, ceded complete control to Disney executives. I'm going to go on because this is amazing. this is a cult. Of course, Disney is a cult.
Well, it's a cult, but it's also like overthrowing part of the country. Not the whole country, but like a part of it.
Yeah, let me read a little more and then we'll let Owen get the last word for our patrons on this After Dark. In early 1967, the Florida legislature created Hallowell's two cities, both named for the artificial reservoirs Disney engineered. Engineers created by obstructing the area's natural water flow. When you visit Disney's Magic Kingdom, you are visiting the city of Bay Lake, Florida. The other was the city of Lake Buena Vista. In both cities, in violation of both the U.S. and Florida constitutions, the Disney-engineered legislation established a property qualification for holding elective office, requiring that each candidate for office there must be the owner, either directly or as a trustee, of real property situated in the city in order to be eligible to hold the office of councilman. Though enacted by the legislature, this and other crucial pieces of Disney-enabling legislation, which would reshape Central Florida and affect the lives of tens of millions of people, was written by teams of Disney lawyers working in New York at the Donovan firm and in Miami.
Did they wear the mouse hat when they working on these bills?
I don't think so. I got a little more here. This is too funny. Disney lawyers, no, you're killing it. Disney lawyers in California signed off on the text before it was flown to Tallahassee, where, without changing a word, Florida's compliant legislators enacted it into law. No one thought of reading it, one ex-lawmaker later remarked. Later, after the houses there were sold, compliant legislatures excluded all the residents of Celebration from Disney's domain to prevent them from voting. Those who were never forgot the day Disney inaugurated what truly would be a magic kingdom in Florida. Magically above the law, the governor and his cabinet came down from Tallahassee. TV crews were in attendance, along with Florida's most eminent civic leaders. Right on schedule, the curtains parted. On the screen, Walt Disney gave his much beloved self-deprecating smile, then announced that in Florida, he was going to create a new kind of America, not just a theme park.
Oh my God, this is...
I love it. It's just like, what are laws?
Right.
What is the Constitution?
Right.
Fancy footwork around that.
It's just stuff in the way. It's just stuff in the way. So you got to use it.
That's crazy.
I love the Disney story. It's so fascinating. Was there anything, Owen, out of that that is the chart for the theme park speaks to? You're nodding your head. I'm interested.
Yeah, well, you're talking about Disney's involvement with the CIA. There are indications. Most people don't know this, but there are indications for one's dealings with the fringes, the occult, the taboo, even intelligence agencies and stuff. For Disney, it's indicated that he had a good time with them. Basically, he had a good time. There were some difficulties. It was stressful. He had to keep up a kind of a mask. What's indicating this? Well, Mars is ruling his eighth house is dealings with spooks, so on and so forth. Mars is very powerful in Capricorn, and when the ruler of a house is strong, that means your dealings in that domain go well. So that's Disney. That Mars, again, once again, we keep coming back to this, was square to his moon in Libra. So what that's doing is it's making trouble with his friendships. It's making trouble with his just state of mind. It's stressful, it's troublesome. I mean, you know, we see things like Disney running off to South America there, just getting stressed. I believe there was even a point after the first main struggle with the animators union where he just went off back home and started designing model trains, you know, not model, but like miniature trains in his backyard. Train lines were an original passion of his, and also something very much to do with Gemini being the sign of transport. But yeah, in terms of Disney's dealings with everything that was under the table and all that kind of thing, that's in there. And it's something that he was quite good at, quite competent with, comfortable with.
That makes total sense. I mean, we know from our core episode too, not just the Disney World development, but during World War II, I mean, Disney was basically turned into the propaganda arm of the US military, and, you know, and Disney, Walt himself going down to South America wasn't necessarily just vacation, but he seemed to have also been making contacts with the intelligence agencies. And there was certainly concern about the political allegiances in South America. So this is all very, very, very interesting.
Huh. This has been a blast.
It has.
Owen Briggs, thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciated it. Brad, this is a hoot. Patrons, thank you for supporting the pod. We've got good things coming. Peace.
Hope you enjoyed it.
And bye.
Yes.